by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make to heaven in the middle of it. Grass make to heaven in the middle. We are grass make to heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. What we have going this week is this Iranian pullback from disruption. And Tucker Carlson was one of the main influences over President Trump in halting this strike that, you know, they got together, the military-industrial complex put together to go back against Iran for their shoot down of a remote vehicle, one of our drones flying over the area of the Hormuz, Strait of Hormuz, which is a supply strait for about 30% of the world's oil. Primarily to India and to China and to the Far East and Japan also. So we're going to start with what Carlson said about this Iranian, you know what I mean, pullback and so forth. And it could have been disastrous, but thank goodness cooler heads and President Trump made a decision 10 minutes from the time it was to be launched, the attack, to pull back because he didn't want to harm 150 so-called Iranian lives that would have been lost because of the U.S. attack. So here we go with Tucker Carlson.
Just 24 hours ago, this country stood on the brink of cataclysm after weeks of slow escalation and without a single vote from the Congress. The United States came within minutes of war with Iran. In response to the destruction of an unmanned drone, American forces nearly launched an airstrike on Iranian targets. According to some reports, our planes were literally in the air. But in the end, it didn't happen. The president pulled back. This morning, he explained why.
They came and they said, sir, we're ready to go. We'd like a decision. I said, I want to know something before you go. How many people will be killed? In this case, Iranians. Mm-hmm. I said, how many people are going to be killed? Sir, I'd like to get back to you on that. Great people, these generals. They said, came back, said, sir, approximately 150. And I thought about it for a second, and I said, you know what? They shot down an unmanned drone, mm-hmm. plane, whatever you want to call it, and here we are sitting with 150 dead people that would have taken place probably within a half an hour after I said, go ahead.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it. I didn't think it was proportionate.
How many people will be killed? The most basic of all questions, but a question that's too rarely asked by leaders contemplating war. 150 people wiped off the planet in retaliation for a broken drone. Every one of them, the president reminded his staff last night, someone with a family. The whole thing, in the end, offended his sense of decency. He said it seemed disproportionate, and it was. Moreover, airstrikes would have led to a wider conflict with Iran. That, of course, was the entire point of it. Policymakers in Washington crave a war with Iran. Last night was supposed to be the first domino. At the last minute, the president thwarted their plans. For that, he's being vilified. Watch CNN's 36-year-old national security analyst attack the president for not killing enough people yesterday.
This is kind of a worst-case scenario. The president is showing that he ostensibly made a decision, had a National Security Council meeting, and wasn't willing to follow through. All in all, this shows gross disorganization and a president who can't seem to make up his mind even on something as important as a military strike on Iran.
Only in foreign policy circles do people say things that stupid. In fact, last night was a high point in the Trump presidency. Bombing Iran would have ended his political career in a minute. There'd be no chance of re-election after that. Ill-advised wars are like doing cocaine. The initial rush rises your poll numbers, but the crash is inevitable. And in this case, it would be horrible. The hangover from an Iraq war would last years. Iran is not Syria or Iraq. It's a big, rich, sophisticated country with an ancient culture and a cohesive population. In some ways, it's an impressive place, not at all like the chintzy prefab capitals of the Arab world, like Riyadh or Dubai. We could beat Iran, but it would not be easy. It would cost trillions of dollars. Many thousands of Americans likely would die. China would love it. They'd be the only winners in that conflict. Donald Trump was elected president precisely to keep us out of disasters like war with Iran. So how did we get so close to starting one? Simple. The neocons still wield enormous power in Washington. They don't care what the cost of a war with Iran is. They certainly don't care what the effect on Trump's political fortunes might be. They despise Donald Trump. Now, one of their key allies is the National Security Advisor of the United States. John Bolton is an old friend of Bill Kristol's. Together, they helped plan the Iraq War. When Bolton made it to the White House, the neocons cheered. Left-wing New York Times columnist Brett Stevens took a break from attacking Donald Trump to celebrate his hiring. Stevens assured MSNBC viewers that John Bolton was a great choice because he would push the president toward war.
He is not the sort of caricaturish hawk that he's been made out to be in some corners of the press. I think someone like Bolton is going to restrain the isolationist impulses that have been really at the heart of Trump's foreign policy thinking.
Got that? John Bolton is going to restrain Donald Trump from avoiding war. And, of course, that's exactly what he's tried to do from the very first day. Shortly before Bolton took his new job, we invited him on this show and asked about some of his many, many previous foreign policy positions. Watch as Bolton denies ever being wrong, ever, about anything, not even a little bit. So you've called for regime change in Iraq, Libya, Iran, and Syria. In the first two countries, we've had regime change. And obviously, it's been, I'd say, a disaster. I think we agree.
No, I don't agree with that. And let me.
You don't think it's been a disaster?
No. I think you need to understand.
Yeah.
Is that life is complicated in the Middle East. And when you say, well, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein was a mistake, well, is simplistic.
I would argue that I'm the one who understands how complicated it is, but just my view.
It's your long experience in foreign policy, I know.
Better record than yours, I would say. Got that? Hillary Clinton's toppling of the Libyan government was not a disaster, says John Bolton. Keep in mind, there are literally slave markets operating in the streets of Tripoli right now. No problem, though. Bolton's fine with that. He's fine with the outcome in Iraq, too. That wasn't a disaster either. According to John Bolton, it was a raging success. We killed hundreds of thousands of people, lost thousands of our own troops, spent more than $1 trillion, all to eliminate a WMD threat that, despite John Bolton's assurances, never existed in the first place. Bolton is glad we did all that, really happy about it. That's demented. Normal people don't talk like that. There's nothing normal about John Bolton. Check out this piece of tape, recently uncovered, in which Bolton promises that we're going to overthrow the government of Iran. Keep in mind that this was filmed long before the Iranians shot down a single drone.
I have said for over 10 years since coming to these events that the declared policy of the United States of America should be the overthrow of the mullah's regime in Tehran. And that's why before 2019, we here will celebrate in Tehran. Thank you very much.
In other words, last night has been in the works for years. John Bolton is a kind of bureaucratic tapeworm. Try as you might, you can't expel him. He seems to live forever in the bowels of the federal agencies, periodically reemerging to cause pain and suffering, but critically, somehow never suffering himself. His life really is Washington in a nutshell. Blunder into obvious catastrophes again and again, refuse to admit blame, and then demand more of the same. That's the John Bolton life cycle. In between administration jobs are always cushy think tank posts, paid speaking gigs, cable news contracts. War may be a disaster for America, but for John Bolton and his fellow neocons, it is always good business.
Well, Tucker hit the nail on the head on that. But the problem with Iran is they have created terrorism, and they've been behind a lot of terrorism and disaster for us. We've lost hundreds of troops to their proxies in Lebanon and so forth. And so and they're funding, you know, the Palestinians and the Gaza with weapons and so forth, and also in Syria and Lebanon. So they're not nice people, see. So some retaliation had to be done, but not on the level that the military industrial war machine had advised Trump, and I think Trump felt that it's just too much in the end. Here's about a clip from President Trump before he gets on the helicopter to go to Camp David, and it's very insightful and it's very recent, just this afternoon.
So we're going to Camp David. We're going to have meetings and a lot of work. Coming back sometime tomorrow, but we're heading out right now to Camp David. I want to say the stock market is on pace to have its best year. I mean, since, I guess, over 50 years, and the Dow is on pace to have its best year in 80 years. It's been 80 years since the Dow has hit. Tariffs are obviously doing very well because we're taking in billions and billions of dollars from China. We would be from others, and we might be from others, but billions of dollars are coming in from China, and frankly, look at what's happening with the stock market, which is pretty much what I've been saying. Also, an article came out this morning that the tariffs are having very little effect on costs going up, and in some cases, no effect, that the countries that the products come from, they are bearing the cost, which is also what I've said. So the Dow is up. Looks like it could be an 80-year high. It's on track for an 80-year high. And the stock market itself is a 50-year high. So I'm sure you're all very happy about that, right? I don't know, unintentional or not. It was probably intentional, as I said. But regardless, they targeted something without a person in it, without a man or a woman, and certainly without anybody from the United States in it. So we want to be proportionate. We're getting a lot of praise for what I did, and we have people on both sides. Some like it, and some probably not as much. My expression is we have plenty of time. We have plenty of time. You understand that? Yeah, these are people that came into the country illegally. They've been served. They've gone through a process of the courts, and they have to be removed from the country. They will be removed from the country. It's having a very big effect on the border, the fact that we're taking them out. The people that came into the country illegally are going to be removed from the country. Everybody knows that. It starts, you know, during the course of this next week, maybe even a little bit earlier than that. And again, everybody that came into the country illegally will be brought out of the country very legally. Now, with that being said, the border is in much better shape. Mexico is doing a good job. We need Congress to fix the loopholes and fix asylum, and we will have the cleanest border there is. We don't know. We'll see. We'll see. Well, some cities are going to fight it, but if you notice, they're generally high-crime cities. If you look at Chicago, they're fighting it, and if you look at other cities, they're fighting it. Many of those cities are high-crime cities, and they're sanctuary cities. The state of Florida is now ending all sanctuary cities. He's doing a very smart thing. Governor DeSantis, he's ending all sanctuary cities in the state of Florida. And I'll tell you, Governor DeSantis has been fantastic. He's right on the ball. And we have others that are following. You'll be seeing a lot of that. People are tired of sanctuary cities and what it does and the crime it brings. They're very tired of it. Well, we'll see what's with Iran. Everybody was saying I'm a warmonger, and now they say I'm a dove. And I think I'm neither. You want to know the truth. I'm a man with common sense, and that's what we need in this country is common sense. But I didn't like the idea of them knowingly shooting down an unmanned drone, and then we kill 150 people. I didn't like that. I can't hear. Yeah, we're moving forward with additional sanctions on Iraq. Good question. And some of them are in place. As you know, we have about as strong a sanction grouping as you could possibly have on any country. But we're putting additional sanctions on. They're going on slowly and in some cases actually pretty rapidly. But Iran, additional sanctions are being put on Iran. Very little. That's what it's all about. You know, we have built, and right now, if you look at the United States, very importantly, we are the number one oil producer, oil and gas in the world, by far. We're way ahead of Russia. We're way ahead of Saudi Arabia. We don't really need the Straits anymore. We take some, but we don't need it. The biggest beneficiary of the Straits is China. 91% of their energy comes out of the Straits. Japan, Indonesia, many other countries need it. So we're doing them a very big service by keeping the Straits open. But this is not about the Straits. This is about Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. Very simple. Because we don't need it, just so you understand. We don't need it.
Yeah, I do, because I have John Bolton, who I would definitely say is a hawk, and I have other people that are on the other side of the equation, and ultimately I make the decision, so it doesn't matter. But I want, for instance, I disagreed very much with John Bolton. His attitude on the Middle East and Iraq was going into Iraq. I think that was a big mistake. I think I've been proven right, but I've been against that forever. John Bolton is doing a very good job, but he takes it generally a tough posture. But I have other people that don't take that posture. But the only one that matters is me, because I'll listen to everybody. And I want people on both sides. Having people on both sides to me is very important. No, I started to hear that it was a lot, but again, no decision was made. I said, you come and see me, and they came and see me at the time. We hadn't done anything, and I asked the question, and I said, I want to know that answer before I make a decision. So we hadn't made a decision to go forward. I said, everybody, we will meet. One thing I want to know, and I want to know it accurately as possible, how many people will die? Just so you know, I come from New York City. In New York City, we have a lot of Iranians, and they're great people. I have friends that are Iranians, many friends. Living in New York City, you meet many Iranians. They're very smart, they're very ambitious, they have tremendous, they're high-quality people. But I have many friends that are Iranian. I don't want to kill 150 Iranians. I understand it. I don't want to kill 150 of anything or anybody unless it's absolutely necessary. And most people very much agree with what I'm doing. Now, if the leadership of Iran behaves badly, then it's going to be a very, very bad day for them. But hopefully, they're smart, and hopefully they really care for their people and not themselves, and hopefully we can get Iran back onto an economic track that's fantastic, where they're a really wealthy nation, which would be a wonderful thing. All those things I want to do. But if they're going to be foolish, that's never going to happen.
Mr. President, you had an announcement earlier that you never met Jean Carroll. There was a photograph of you and her in the late 1980s.
I have no idea who this woman is. This is a woman who's also accused other men of things, as you know. It is a totally false accusation. I think she was married, as I read. I have no idea who she is. But she was married to a, actually, nice guy, Johnson, a newscaster. Standing with my coat on in a line. Give me a break. With my back to the camera. I have no idea who she is. What she did is, it's terrible. What's going on? So it's a total false accusation, and I don't know anything about her. And she's made this charge against others. And you know,
people have to be careful because they're playing with very dangerous territory. And when they do that, it is happening more and more. When you look at what happened to Justice Kavanaugh and you look at what's happening to others, you can't do that for the sake of publicity. New York Magazine is a failing magazine. It's ready to go out of business from what I hear. They'll do anything they can. But this was about many men, and I was one of the many men that she wrote about. It's a totally false accusation. I have absolutely no idea who she is. There's some picture where we're shaking hands. It looks like at some kind of event. I have my coat on. I have my wife standing next to me. And I didn't know her husband, but he was a newscaster. But I have no idea who she is. None whatsoever. It's a false accusation, and it's a disgrace that a magazine like New York, which is one of the reasons it's failing, people don't read it anymore. So they're trying to get readership by using me. It's not good. You know, there were cases that the mainstream media didn't pick up, and I don't know if you've seen them, and they were put on Fox, but there were numerous cases where women were paid money to say bad things about me. You can't do that. You can't do that. And those women did wrong things. That women were actually paid money to say bad things about me. But here's the case. It's an absolute disgrace that she's allowed to do that. The deportation raids, as you call them, are really a group of very, very good law enforcement people going by the law, going by the rules, going by our court system, and taking people out of our country who came into our country illegally. They came into our country illegally, and we're taking them out legally. We're bringing them back to their country. I want to thank, while I'm here, I want to thank Mexico. So far, Mexico has been really good. They made an agreement, probably, not probably, because of tariffs, but they made an agreement, and so far they've really honored the agreement. A lot of things are changing. But again, if Congress gave us something quickly on asylum, something quickly on loopholes, where we get rid of the loopholes, the border would be so beautiful. But the Democrats just won't do it. But maybe now they will, because there's no question you have a national emergency. They said that in the last caravan, they had hundreds of people that commit crime trying to come into our country. We're not letting them. And now Mexico is bringing them back. But they had hundreds of people, hundreds, that were criminals in the last caravan. We cannot allow that to happen. We're not letting them in our country. One other thing, we're very focused on MS-13, getting them out. And I hope you're not going to stick up too much for MS-13. But we're very focused. ICE. ICE is, these are fantastic people. We're very, very focused on getting MS-13 out of this country. How are you?
Good. I have a question on Iran. The 150 estimate has repeated on it. The 150 estimate that you got late on Thursday night. Why was that different from the estimate you got earlier in the day from your national security team?
It wasn't really. I didn't talk too much about that. Again, no decision to go forward was made because I said, we'll meet at a certain time before the, and nothing goes forward until we meet. I didn't want anybody doing anything. And when we met, they gave me a rough estimate earlier, but I wanted a more accurate estimate. The more accurate estimate were, I won't go into the number of sites, but you've guessed that pretty much right. You have in particular, all right? But it was the number of sites. And it was on average 40 to 50 people in each site. And when they shot down an unmanned plane or drone, I didn't like it.
That came from an attorney in the Pentagon and through the White House.
No, that came from me.
You know, I did the estimate through.
It did, but it was given to me by a general. I had a long talk with Dunford. He's a great gentleman. He was. Dunford did a great job. Dunford is a terrific man, and he's a terrific general. Yeah. I'll be talking about Iran at Camp David, yeah. We have a series of meetings and, more importantly, a series of very well-connected phone calls. We have a great phone system up there, and as you know. So I'll be doing a lot of work. We may release it later. We may. Look, Iran right now is an economic mess. They're going through hell. The sanctions have hit them hard. More sanctions are going to be put on, a lot more. It's hard to believe you can even put on, but it's a mess. All I want is no nuclear weapons. Under the horrible Obama deal, he gave them $150 billion. He gave them $1.8 billion in cash. Think of that, in cash. Many plane loads of cash. Gave him $1.8 billion in cash, and he got nothing. But the thing he really didn't get was good inspection rights, because the most primary places you couldn't go to, you couldn't inspect. We haven't seen them in years. The other thing he didn't get is time. Because in a very short number of years, they will legally be able to make a nuclear weapon. That's unacceptable. And remember this, the deal wasn't even ratified in Congress. It never got proper, in terms of treaty, it never got proper authorization from Congress. So with all of that, it was very important to me. So we'll start all over. We could have a deal with them very quickly if they want to do it. It's up to them. But if Iran wants to become a wealthy nation again, become a prosperous nation, we'll call it, let's make Iran great again. Does that make sense? Make Iran great again. It's okay with me. But they're never going to do it if they think in 5 or 6 years they're going to have a nuclear weapon. I know too much about nuclear, a lot about nuclear. And let me just tell you, they're not going to have a nuclear weapon. If that's safe, and it has very little to do with the oil. Because, again, China gets its oil 91%. Japan gets its oil 60%. Indonesia, so many other countries. What it has to do with, very simply, is the fact is we're not going to have Iran have a nuclear weapon. And when they agree to that, they are going to have a wealthy country. They're going to be so happy, and I'm going to be their best friend. I hope that happens. I hope that happens, but it may not.
Would it have been different if it was 10 to 15 casualties instead of 100 to 115 casualties?
It's anything is a lot when they shoot down an unmanned, okay? So anything's a lot. I didn't like it. I didn't like it.
Not have to reflect that on
it. Say it.
If they shoot down another unmanned drone, will you also know?
We'll see. But I don't think that'll happen. I don't think that's happened. And if you noticed, there was a plane with 38 people yesterday. Did you see that? I think that's a big story.
Is that accurate?
They had it in their sights and they didn't shoot it down.
That was accurate?
I think they were very wise not to do that. And we appreciate that they didn't do that. But they had a plane in their sights, 38 people on the plane, and they didn't shoot it down. And I think that was a very wise decision. And I think that's something that we very much appreciate.
Brought to a plan, planned strike, and didn't have a fully formed estimate on casualties.
No, they brought me a great plan, but I wanted to know at the end. I wanted an accurate count. They gave me very odd numbers. I wanted an accurate count as to how many people would be killed, how many Iranians would be killed. And as I said, coming from New York, I know a lot of Iranians. They're great people. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's always on the table until we get this solved. Yeah. We have a tremendously powerful military force in that area. It's always on the table until we get this solved. Thank you.
That was President Trump addressing a pool of reporters there waiting at the moment of his climbing on board his helicopter to go to Camp David. That's where he gets out and says a lot of very interesting things. So This is very interesting. Now I'm going to conclude our program this evening with a couple of clips, and they're very all important in the sense that they have to do with China and Huawei. That company it's a Chi-Com put up job company, and it's gotten into manufacturing and digital, you could say, manufacturing and 5G. They're pushing that on a large scale. And we have the first clip that's coming up is Gordon Chang. He's the author of The Coming Collapse of China, and this was written a number of years ago. It hasn't totally occurred yet, but their economy is not in good shape. So here's Gordon Chang, and then we're going to follow that by a 5G expert. Here we go with Gordon Chang.
Just about everything is on the line in our struggle with China. And I'll try and, as Frank said, put this into context, because this is really where we determine our future for the next decade and perhaps decades to come. And as we have heard tonight, this is the struggle of our generation. You know, we talk about a trade war with China, and President Trump has imposed tariffs. Those tariffs, we should remember, are supposed to be a remedy for the theft of U.S. intellectual property by China. Each year, China takes somewhere between $150 to $600 billion of U.S. IP. This is a grievous wound to the U.S. economy because, increasingly, we have an economy based on innovation. And if we cannot commercialize our technical learning and all the rest of it, then we don't have an economy of the future, and we don't have a society of the future. We Americans think of this as a trade war. The Chinese, though, are thinking in much broader terms. In the middle of last month, on the 13th, People's Daily, which is the most authoritative publication in China, said that it is now in a people's war with the United States. This is broad. As Frank said, this is unrestricted warfare. We're talking about military issues as well as economic, technological, and from the Chinese perspective, perhaps the most important is an ideological contest with the United States. Now, analysts, and you've heard this so many times, analysts will tell you that really it's the U.S. and China are struggling for dominance. And this feeds into one of Beijing's narrative, that the United States is in terminal decline, and really what we're trying to do is jealously preserve our role in the international system. Well, yeah, we are trying to preserve our role, but more important, we are trying to preserve the international system itself. This international system of treaties, laws, norms, conventions, rules, this is what we are trying to protect. China, unfortunately, does not accept that. Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has in recent years been talking in terms of Tianxia, or, in other words, China's right to rule all under heaven. You've all heard the concept of mandate of heaven. This is what he is referring to. So, in 2017, in September, his foreign minister wrote an article in Study Times, which is the Communist Party's Central Party School newspaper, a very influential organ. And in this article, Wang Yi said that Xi Jinping thought, and in Communist Party lingo, a thought is an important ideological body of work. Wang Yi wrote that Xi Jinping thought, made innovations on, and transcended 300 years of Western international relations thinking. Well, if you take 2017, you subtract 300 years, you almost get to 1648. 1648 is the year of the Treaty of Westphalia, which establishes the current international system. We call our system Westphalian. It is the system that recognizes sovereign states. They sovereign states, they compete, and they cooperate, but that's our framework. By the use of the word transcended, Wang Yi was saying that Xi Jinping doesn't see sovereign states, or at least no more than one of them, being China. Xi Jinping not only thinks and talks Tianxia, he actually acts that way. In April of last year, the Chinese lasered an Air Force C-130 cargo plane, blinded two of the pilots. If you blind the pilots of a plane, we have to assume that the Chinese were trying to bring down the plane. If you're trying to bring down a plane, we have to assume that they were intending to kill the crew. Last spring, Chinese used sonic attacks, and they caused brain injuries to our diplomats at the Guangzhou consulate. So we know that the Chinese believe that they have the right to do whatever they want, because that's the only justification for these acts, that we don't have sovereignty and that the Chinese are rulers of the heavens. unfortunately. We have yet to disabuse them of that notion, because when we look at this, this is their notion of a dictatorial one-party state determining what happens in the rest of the world. For us, we've got to then think about this people's war, because this people's war is much broader than what we Americans think. And as we go forward, we have to understand that the Chinese declared this war, they're going to wage it, and we have no choice but to respond to it. And by God, because this is the struggle that defines our generation, we must win it. Thank you.
That was Gordon Chang, and he spoke very eloquently about the struggle that's going on. The Shycoms are deadly serious about dominating us and worldwide. But in many cases, they're in concert, in partnership with some of the largest financial interests in the world. So it's not clear-cut and totally black and white all the time. And so that's why it's hard to analyze. Coming up next is a 5G expert, and he makes a very important point about the ability of 5G to see into all kinds of industry and military, industrial complexes, and so forth is a real danger. So here we go with this 5G expert.
To talk about that and what we must do to counter it, I'm very pleased to have Andrew Whitney. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Frank. Good to meet you all. Privileged to be on the stage with these guys. Terrible to have to follow them, so I'll do my best. But the topic in particular that Frank's mentioned is the whole 5G situation and Huawei, which you hear a lot about on the news at the moment. It's very topical. We're going to pull these Huawei switches out. We're going to ban them from the market, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of people talk a lot about 5G, but without necessarily knowing what it is. So I thought what I might do is just very quickly explain what 5G really is, because there's a tendency to think it's just sort of, you know, one more generation than 4G. It's a sort of a gentle iteration of something that's been going on for a while. It really is a massive step change, fifth generation technology. You'll hear lots of acronyms and technical terms thrown around in certain circles. The rest of the time, what you'll hear in the mainstream media is that 5G is really about just getting movies even quicker, being able to play video games even more easily, and that your refrigerator can order its own food, and that sort of stuff. And that's basically what you get told. And, you know, where's the harm in that, right? Fine. That's far from the reality of what 5G really is, or what it's capable of, more importantly. And I should say at the outset that 5G, I mean, it offers tremendous potential for improvement of people's livelihoods and opportunity and well-being and so forth. So it's a wonderful technology if it's used in the right way and if it's not controlled by the wrong people. Literally the worst thing that could happen to the world right now, in my opinion, is Chinese control of the 5G space, and I'll explain why. To understand the 5G debate, if you will, essentially all 5G revolves around discussions about spectrum, so where these transmissions occur, and who owns the spectrum bandwidth and that sort of thing. It's about data and computation power, so data and compute, and it's about cost. That's really what it all boils down to. If you take any of the other issues, they really do boil down to those three things. So that's important to bear in mind. You will hear lots of acronyms thrown around and technical terms, but really let's talk about the practical applications of 5G so you have a sense of why it is a problem if it ends up in the wrong hands. You know, massive amounts of data transmitted reliably with very little what's called latency. So it means there's no delay. What does that give you? That gives you the ability to do surgery at a distance. As a surgeon, I could sit here manipulating a robot which is performing open heart surgery on you on the other side of the world because there's no lag time in the feedback system because the technology is just so superior. So that's one small example. It also means you can have entire factories running themselves independently without worrying that something's going to fall off the production line and not get caught and this, that, and the other. It allows you to have immense control over systems. We'll come back to that. You'll hear a lot of talk about the Internet of Things. So the Internet of Things, it means everything becomes a sensor. Your car is full of sensors. You're wearing health sensors. You've got sensors in everything. And again, we get back to the refrigerator example. It can tell what level everything's at and order more stuff automatically. Again, sounds great, but you need an enormous amount of compute to manage all the data flowing to and from those systems in the moment, in real time. And again, we'll come back to why that's an issue. Vehicles, they call it kind of vehicle to everything. So vehicles will have sensors. They'll be picking up all the information from all those gadgets on you as you walk down the street to figure out whether you're about to leap into the path of the vehicle. It'll be picking up information from infrastructure. It'll be picking up information from the traffic grid that says, nah, steer in that way because there's too much congestion happening over there. So again, sounds great, right? Terrific. The problem with all this is all of those data streams, if you run the network on Chinese equipment, all those data streams then belong to the Chinese. And this is where the problem starts. Because the Chinese would then have absolute visibility into everything. From a corporate standpoint and a commercial economic standpoint, that means they would be able to see the precise stock levels at any facility, anywhere in the country. They'd be able to see all the stock items in any truck moving anywhere. And that gives you a tremendous opportunity to manipulate pricing to destroy entire industries. I'll give you a practical example of this right now. Right now on Amazon, there are 500,000 counterfeit retailers from China. And what they do is they'll take a snapshot of your website. If you've come up with a gadget, they'll copy the gadget, create a fake website using all of your website content, and they'll put it up there for literally a penny less on Amazon. Well, of course, the pricing algorithm on Amazon then puts them top of the list, and you go on there to shop for that widget, and you just click the one at the top of the list, right? You don't go rolling through pages. So they just got a grip of that company's entire market by literally dropping a penny in price. They never developed anything. They never developed any IP. They just stole it all, basically. That's a crude example using today's technology. Now, you imagine if you can see across every logistics supply chain in an instant. You know, that's a tremendous power that can be wielded. Now imagine that you can see, and this has actually happened, the Fitbits on everybody's armed forces in a moment, and you can figure out what state of health they're in, how dehydrated they are, and you also know where their water supplies are, what their ammunition levels are, how much sleep they've had. You can start to figure out who to wallop first and in which order. And it just goes on and on and on. And I can walk you through dozens of these examples, but all those control systems and those factories that are running off this, you can shut them down in an instant. Or you can turn everything from your refrigerator to your toaster into an incendiary weapon by just basically running it, you know, too high on its clock cycle. And so what starts off as a terrific technology in the wrong hands turns into an enormous liability. And as I said at an event we had in Washington earlier in the week, if I had a choice between control of every weapon system out there right now, all the nuclear missiles, this, that, and the other under the sun, or control of the 5G system, I would take that 7 days a week. Because before you've even launched any of that stuff at me, I've destroyed every single one of your industries. I've wiped out your forces. I've cut them off. I've sent harrowing messages to your forces' families directly to individuals in the rear that will terrify them. I will vaporize your support as a politician if you're out there going against me by sending, again, targeted messaging. And you can do all of that at the speed of light using a 5G network that you control, quite apart from the fact you're reading all the SIGINT and everything else. So it is absolutely terrifying as a weapon. Now, we've all been led to believe that we've completely lost this battle and Huawei is the only one out there. By the way, people say to me all the time, how come Huawei is the only one out there? You know, what about this company? What about that company? Essentially, they were all either put out of business by predatory pricing over the years, or they were acquired, or, you know, their IP was stolen and then they were put out of business. So it means that Huawei is one of the only competitors out there now. And the reason they're the only name that comes up is partially because of that. It's also partially because of the way spectrum is allocated. And because most countries do an auction, and essentially the highest bidder wins and gets that spectrum, it means a lot of these networks have very little left to spend on equipment. So the Chinese know this. They put the predatory price switches out there, and of course that's what gets sucked in as the equipment base. So then you end up in a situation where economically, because of the commercial business model of networks, they're the only choice, and also technically they're the only one available in the marketplace.
So, Andrew, as we are over time now, would you say another minute and say what we do about it?
So, what you would need to solve this problem is you would need to have a secure supply chain solution, have it all made in America again, in a secure supply chain. You would need to have an outstanding computational solution that allowed you to deliver all of this at a very effective cost point. So to have end-to-end cyber protection across all these networks, secure supply chain, and another feature which is very important is to have something which is EMP attack resilient. So you can't have your networks knocked out by an electromagnetic pulse attack, something people always overlook, and yet it's absolutely part of the military doctrine that Kevin referred to. It's one of their opening gambits in any type of situation. It's also a somewhat unattributable attack mode.
The danger of 5G in the hands of Huawei is very great. We've got to start doing what Trump is actually creating a trend towards, and that's manufacturing internally many of these devices in the switching and digital industry, and that would greatly help us. Also, we're going to end with another clip from this same symposium, and it gets into social profiling and everything and the danger of China. So here we go now with the final clip.
So in that context, talk a little bit about the prospects for, you know, dissent, if there is any, in China, and the danger that they are now exporting this technology, along with 5G, to other nations around the world as well.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. When you look at the Chinese people, there is, I think, the most important thing is that the party has lost hearts and minds. And we've seen so many symptoms of dissent, where the party understands that it can coerce people, but it can't lead anymore. So what Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has been trying to do is, as Frank mentioned, to utilize the instruments of coercion to make sure that there is no or very little dissent. And one of the most important things here is the social credit system, which I think most people have heard of. Right now in China, there are a number of local social credit system experiments. And some of them succeed and have popular support. Many of them do not. But what Xi Jinping is trying to do is to take these local experiments and to expand it nationwide. The goal is by 2020 to have a nationwide system. I don't think they're actually going to be able to do that by next year, but within, you know, 3 or 4 years, they probably will be able to solve the technological problems and actually put this into place. What this means is that every Chinese resident citizen will get an updated score, and that score will be changed because of behaviors. So, for instance, jaywalking will lower your score. If, for instance, you pay your taxes on time, your score will be increased. If you criticize Xi Jinping, you're in trouble. What we have seen so far with these local social credit systems is that people who have low scores are not entitled to send their children to private school. They can't board a plane. May not even be able to walk out their front door, which is what Chinese officials have been talking about. So it's an incredibly coercive program. This is in part because Xi Jinping believes that the Communist Party should have absolute control over the Chinese people. Now, pushing too hard, they have created their own adversaries, and we have seen symptoms of dissent. So Xi Jinping is not only trying to control people through the social credit system, but also through the Great Firewall, which attempts to de-link China from the global internet, and other means. And we've seen, Kevin talked about the concentration camps in what the Chinese call Xinjiang, and they're now starting to spread to Tibet, along with a number of other things. But fortunately, Frank, you know, no government has ever been able to do this over a long period of time. With China's technological superiority, as we've seen, and as Andrew's talked about, they can make great inroads. But the Chinese people, like people in other countries, have always been able to express dissent, and at certain points in time, they have been able to overturn mighty-looking governments. And China's problem right now is, for the first time in a generation, they are facing an economic downturn. Xi Jinping has adopted all of these sort of Maoist state-dominated policies. It's affecting the economy. The trade war, quote-unquote, is also affecting the economy. And for a Chinese generation of people who have never known a downturn, this is eroding support for the Communist Party. So you put all this together, Frank. I don't know how it occurs, but clearly at some point we will see a break in the Communist Party's grip on the Chinese people. It's happened in certain periods in history. It will happen again.
Well, we can't leave on that happy note, can we? No, I hope you're right, Gordon, needless to say, and we're gonna tease out some of these ideas a little bit further. We had Kevin, I think, a question that you'd be particularly suitable to discuss, as you've given a lot of thought and attention to this phenomenon of electromagnetic pulse and the degree to which our country is very susceptible to it. Andrew has been working the technology piece of it. Kevin has been joining us in warning about the policy pieces of it. Here again, the president has recently issued an executive order saying we have to protect our grid. The Chinese clearly understand that we haven't so far, among others. How vulnerable are we, and to what extent can these sorts of technologies be used as new avenues by them to penetrate and subvert the grid upon which, fundamentally, all of our lives depend?
Well, the reality is this is a nonpartisan issue. I know that some people tend to lean conservative or Republican or whatever. But the reality of it is Ted Koppel wrote a book titled Lights Out. Any adversary of the United States understands that you can end the nation if you can take the power grid down for any length of time. That's just a fact. And our adversaries understand it better than most. In fact, it was written up extensively in Unrestricted Warfare, where they said a single man-made stock market crash, an electromagnetic pulse. This is a part of the doctrine, not just of China, but Iran and North Korea and Russia. And they've known about it. This technology has been around forever. And Frank and I attended a conference that we had at Maxwell Air Force Base, Air Force University, Lieutenant General Stephen Quast, convened the best engineers, the best minds. But here's the reality. You sit there and you understand this is a fact. You can take our grid down. Now, there are some Chinese efforts, and there's a great article the Center for Security Policy just posted, where there's Chinese influence efforts to convince the Edison Electric Institute and others, oh, no, don't worry about this. And you see a lot of don't worry about this. This is a fact. Every engineer I met with said, yes, you can do this. Everyone that's credible in this world understands that you can take a power grid down, and if you do, it ends the nation if you take it down for a year or more. 90% plus of Americans would die. The Chinese know this, and that's a first-line attack. And guess what? They could come in, do an EMP, and then show up on the doorstep and say, but we will supply, rebuild, and so forth, and make us a slave state if they wanted to. That's the risk, and we have to protect our grid. But there is an effort in Washington to prevent us from protecting our grid. There is a report that came out while we were in Alabama at the Air Force Base that came out that is a power industry report that basically said, no, it's not a problem, it can't happen. I'm telling you, it's a reality, and it's not a reality just from the Chinese being able to do it. If we're not careful, the sun will send out an electromagnetic pulse through a coronal mass ejection that could do it. But the Chinese have infiltrated our government and attempted to tell us that this is not a problem, we should never worry about it. And I'll just give one quick story. I spoke at the Defense Intelligence Agency. The China analyst, the top of the China desk, was a man named Lonnie Henley. I don't know if you know Lonnie. He knows you, Gordon, because Lonnie Henley said no credible China expert believes that China is really a threat. He's the head of the China desk, the Asia desk, at the DIA. General Flynn, Lieutenant General Flynn, brought me in to debate him. I said, why do you want a money manager from Dallas to come in and talk to this guy? He brought in Michael Swain, who is Carnegie Institute for World Peace, who is a very soft on China, and the former investment banker, the World Bank number two, was a Chinese citizen. They came in, and I'm debating, and our moderator is a man reprimanded by the DIA because he went into court and defended his mentor, a man named Monoperto, who was convicted of spying for China. And these are the people in the government that are telling our government China is not a problem. They have infiltrated our government. So I said, he said, no credible China expert. I said, how about Gordon Chang? He said, oh, well, Gordon. How about Mike Pillsbury? Oh, well, Mike. How about Andy Marshall, who was the head of the Office of Net Assessment? Oh, he dismissed every one of them, but I'm telling you, they were wrong.
Thank you, Kevin. And as I said, Andrew, I appreciate what you're doing in the technology space to actually build systems that are protected against this kind of phenomenon, both in the computational sense and the energy space. But one of the questions that we've had, which I'm sure all of you have been hearing something about, is that there are actually health risks associated with 5G. And I gather you're a little skeptical about that, but talk us through the science here.
Sure.
Do we understand it?
Yes, right. So this comes back to this whole, you know, I said that 5G is kind of about spectrum management, and then it's about data and compute, and then it's about cost, basically. So very, very, very quickly, because I don't know kind of who studied what at school, but you've got a couple of things in physics to do with them. So you've got wavelength, which is the length of a wave, oddly enough. And then you've got frequency, which is like kind of how much of this up and down there is in a given instant of time. Basic rule of thumb is the lower the frequency, the longer the wavelength, right? The longer the wavelength, the further it can travel, but the less information it can carry, the less data it can carry, right? So that's why submarine communications, they'll go all the way around the world. Whales, for example, you know, very, very long wavelengths, low tones. So they'll go a long way, but they can't carry much data. So that part of the spectrum's no good if you want to push a huge amount of data around an enormous country like the US, for example. So now you're thinking, well, maybe it's the upper end of the spectrum. Well, the upper part of the spectrum's fantastic for carrying a lot of data, but it won't go a long way, and you have to put a ton of power into it, you know, to carry that data. So that's why if you drive around town, you've got your country station, your rock station on FM, and it's really clear. You go out of town, they'll just disappear. That's because they can't push it very far, and then you're stuck with the kind of AM stuff, which is that sort of banda music, which probably plays on the moon, because it's the only, when you get into the desert, it's the only stuff you can ever hear. Yeah, so or talk radio, right? Because there's no information in any of those guys. So you know, you can push that NPR, you can push that on a
go easy on the talk radio bit here.
Okay, sorry. Present company excluded.